Welcome back to another episode of the Black Art Podcast with me, Lloyd.
Me, Jake.
It's the post-Blackpool come down. How you feeling, man?
I'm feeling strange. I'm half elated, half crushed, depressed, whimsical, creative, thankfully. But it's a strange one. I can't even remember what episode we're on. 43, 42?
40-something. I feel like this Blackpool was cathartic for you. Do you know, have you ever seen those shows where they go to like an old zoo and they find the monkey that was stolen and put into captivity for 20 years and they release it back into the wild? That's what it was like watching you frolic through the streets and the convention of Blackpool this year.
You know what? I did have a lot of weird nostalgia because I went there a few days early. We were going to record a podcast last week. It didn't happen just with timing and stuff. And I went there a few days early to kind of set up a little base and do some testing. I wanted to test some things that I had coming out. And I also just wanted to fuck around. And it reminded me so much of when I was a kid and I'd go there. Just walking up and down the prom of a night, just looking at the tower, playing in the amusement places on my own.
That's kind of cool that you did that. And then you stayed actually for like an extra day after it too. Was it the whole of the Monday and then into Tuesday?
Yeah, I was there like nearly a week and a half.
My God. You know, like you see those plague movies where someone is immune, like I Am Legend?
Yeah.
Robert Neville? Is that the guy's
name? Yeah.
You're like the Robert Neville. Like I couldn't survive 8 days there like without catching something terrible.
Oh, dude. I love it, man. I mean, it's an hour and 20 minutes. It's on the train also from Liverpool. I've always been there, like up and down. So it's just, it's like second home.
To be honest, I probably would have stayed longer. Obviously, I got a baby at home and a wife. So it's not so practical for me to spend 8 days in a place. The mission with Blackpool for me is being in South Wales is that it's just that little bit too far. Like 3 hour drives, not a problem. You can do that. You know, can be a bit silly, but you can do that in a day there and back and stuff. But it, depending on traffic, and as always roadworks, like that M5 is just a car park basically. Then it turns it into, you know, can be 5 to 7. I've done like a, I think I did like an 11 hour journey back from there once because it was so bad.
Jeez.
Never know. So I couldn't stay the whole time. But you know what? I had the best Blackpool ever this year, man.
Did you?
Yeah. Really enjoyed it. I don't know about you. Did you?
You know what? We say that we don't talk about ourselves or like this, you know, our lives at the start of a podcast too much, but we kind of have to because it's Blackpool.
Yes.
But it was a bit of a strange one. There was a bit of a weird mood in the air.
Really?
So, I feel like...
Describe
it. I mean, I don't know. There was stuff to do with... I know people were like annoyed at the queues and stuff this year. It was a weird system this year.
Yeah.
The actual institution itself, kind of. I mean, Blackpool is the same as always. It's Blackpool. It's always going to be Blackpool. So it was exactly the same in some ways, and in some ways it was super different, the experience itself.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. There was like they're growing it, and I love that Magic is growing. It feels like Magic is bigger than ever before, which is incredible. Because I and you probably do, but I remember the days when the industry was, you know, struggling. I'm fortunate. Like I know I work for Murphy's, and so I get to sort of see how it's affecting the industry in other ways. And I'd say, you know, it's like officially we're in a golden era.
Hell yeah, man!
From that side of things, like unprecedented record levels.
Demographic wise as well, like diversity wise, it's a golden age, man. It's so good going and not just seeing 760 plus year old men in yellow suits.
Yeah, which is nothing wrong if you're in that demographic, because I do know.
No, there's nothing wrong with that at all. It's just been that way for 60 years.
Yeah, exactly. But the other thing is, it's so nice to just see a big amount of people actively interested in Magic. And the one thing I kept saying to you a couple of times over was, I've never seen so many like regular, not lay people, but it always felt like, and I hope this doesn't rub anyone up the wrong way, but if you were a magician, the instant thought is that you're an eccentric character, you know, and especially in Britain, people think of British people as eccentric anyway, but the mad top hatter, the people that always dress as the Joker for Halloween, or it's the people in like top hat and tails or the clowns, a kid show, it's nothing wrong with being a clown. But What I kept saying to you is like, it just seems like there's so many regular looking people this time around.
Yeah, dude, it's not just the freaks and geeks anymore.
Which,
There's
you know,
nice,
for us freaks and geeks,
there's
right here.
attractive people now in Magic.
Yeah, but it's just what I like about that so much is that the more commonplace magic is, the better it is for magic. The more people will think about hiring magicians for their events, the more people are happy to watch magic. It used to be a fringe entertainment, you know. There still is now, but there used to be a time when people would say, you'd say, like, do you want to see a magic trick? And someone would go, I don't like magic. You know, this still happens. But now more than ever, it's so like people know a bit because it's so more commonplace. It's the fact that like they know what they get in. So they see someone on Britain's Got Talent or America's Got Talent or Penn and Teller Fool Us, and they're like, oh, this is really cool. This is not intrusive. They're not going to steal my thoughts and turn me into the devil, or they're not going to do voodoo and witchcraft, which is can be done. But you know, it seems like more acceptable and more welcomed, and because there's so many people involved, I don't know. But yeah,
Yeah, well, the
I understand what you're saying with the organization of it. I mean, they book so many lecturers and so many events, which is incredible. But you also can't get into all those events unless you're an hour early. Like this
no.
year, I had to queue, like Ben Hart's show. I had to be there an hour early, and even then, people who were an hour early still didn't get in.
Yeah.
It also means missing other events to be in that queue. And
Yeah,
while there's
like you
other events
said,
going on, you're
growing
missing.
pains.
Yeah, exactly. They need to work on some logistic things for sure.
Yeah, I mean,
And then
it take a lot for like the Blackpool organizers to piss me off. Nothing's pissed me off. It's just it is growing pains.
yeah, they got it. Yeah, I think you've got to go there to come back, haven't you? You've got to realize that the capacity is too much to if you know he, who knows what was going to happen. And the thing is, because there's not designated bums in, there's not designated seat numbers, you don't know who's
Yeah.
going to turn up to watch lecture. So there were lectures that weren't full, and then there were some that were stuffed. So
Yeah.
they can't go off that presenter. But you know, it was a hiccup for sure, but it didn't ruin the weekend, not at
No,
all.
hell no, dude. Hell no. And I mean, Blackpool's so much more than just the and the gala shows anyway. It always
Yes.
has been, always will be. What was your favorite moment of Blackpool? I assume it wasn't sitting in a lecture.
Ooh, good question. My favorite moment of Blackpool. Can you tell me yours? Do you have one? Because I don't have a favorite right now.
I probably have like a top five that I could go through.
Could you please?
Yeah, man. So it was either the first or second night in the Ruskin, chilling with Relish and John Morton and Darren and a few people, and just jamming for a few hours. That was really good. And then when we went back to the Airbnb, me, you, and Darren, and we jammed for a good few
Love
hours.
that.
That was brilliant. Pranking young Sam Sugarman's always good.
Oh, that was definitely the highlight for me. The prank on Sam was phenomenal. So, do you want to explain to everyone what we did? What
Yeah,
you did?
I don't think I've laughed this hard at a convention for years, man. So, Ultramantic, and I think it was with TCC or maybe not, but Ultramantic had a release called Dynamic Sharpie, which was a telekinesis effect using a Sharpie where you could move it supposedly with your mind, and it super super versatile. For I'm surprised at how cheap it was. I mean, some people scoffed at the price, but for what it is, that is very very cheap. That should have been a lot more. So they didn't have much stock. People instantly flocked to go grab it, and young Sam Sugarman, our little South Welsh friend, ran out barely dressed on the first day to try and get one, and he came back to the Airbnb, his cheeks puffy and rosy and red, smiling to himself because he'd managed to acquire one, and then spent the next half an hour playing with it and annoying everyone. But
And then it
and
stopped
then
working.
it stopped working. Yeah, it.
And he got very frustrated and annoyed and started messaging the creators who had run out of stock to not replace it.
He didn't, he, you know, the creators were lovely and he didn't say anything bad to them. It's
Oh,
not unlike.
no. Yeah, no, not at all. He was like, hey, can I? But Jake had played a funny. The dynamic Sharpie was actually fine and brilliantly working. But what did you do, Jake?
Oh, I was very, very naughty. Tyler Lunsford, our American friend, our cowboy magician buddy, was playing with it on the floor, as he often does. And when it rolled behind him, I switched it out with another Sharpie that had a magnet in the exact same spot as the dynamic Sharpie and just pushed it back out.
So Sam was actually sat there trying to get a regular Sharpie to roll on the floor, and then he started charging it as well.
But it went on for longer than I thought it would go on for, with poor Sam looking like he was about to top himself.
Yeah, he was so upset about it, but it was too funny to not do.
The poor lad spent his pocket money on, a high ticket item, and
And we were
I just
pretending that they'd
swapped.
sold him a Sharpie with a cricket inside.
Oh, God.
Yeah, so anyway, we were laughing. We were laughing. Man, I was telling everyone who'd listen to me about that as well.
Oh, really?
Absolutely everyone, yeah.
Yeah. And you know what was strange this year was the year of injuries.
Oh yeah, well, yeah. So you got something stuck in your head.
Yeah, man. I got a magnet stuck in my brain. It's still there right now, actually. It went in my ear. And
Yeah, do you want to tell everyone what, how, when, why?
I was doing a witch hand effect, a very old witch hand effect, with a little capsule with a small magnetic ball inside. So if a magnet went anywhere near the capsule, the ball would jump up and down, and you'd be able to hear it. So usually I would place it behind my ear, and if someone held their hand up next to my head, I could hear which hand they had they had this little magnetic ball in, basically. But I was showing someone in the Ruskin how it used to be done, and I placed her in my ear and said, it's a lot louder if you put it in your ear like this. And then it just slipped down into the depths of my spinal cavity or something. I don't know where it is. It's in some kind of weird.
Is it still in there?
Yeah, I don't know where it is. It's burrowing itself deeper into
Dude,
my brain.
honestly, you absolutely have to get that out.
I like it.
No, but it's gonna, if that little like plastic shell splits open, it's gonna like fragment into your ear.
If it splits open, it'll be easier to get out, I think.
No, because they can pull it out with a magnet right now, but if they don't, they're gonna have to go in with like super surgical tweezers.
Dude, they can't. I found the most powerful magnet. Like, I bought it years ago. It cost me a bomb. I
Yeah,
can't
but
get
they're
it
gonna have
out.
to put, they can put a magnet down in on a stick.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was trying last night when I was doing some DIY surgery, but whatever. I'll get it sorted soon, but podcast is more important.
Man.
And there was the. Everyone seemed to get injured. I'm not going to go through the list of people, but there was some horrific injuries.
Yeah, well, anyway, man, it was just so. There was so much good stuff. I put like last year for me, like, because I was part of it last year. I did that lecture after it, because it was like a packed house. Like after it, and I said, I explained that I was with it with Kaylee. It was just non-stop, like people, lovely people too. Can't like confuse that, but I was being pulled from pillar to post. Everyone wanted to stop and like say hello, take a photo, sign things. And like I didn't even get around the dealers hall last year. Like I tried for the 3 days of the convention to do the full dealers hall, and I couldn't because I stopped and chatting to like everyone. This year, it was more like photographs and signing than ever, but less frenzied.
Yeah.
And also, I had a lot of help of you and Sam to like sort of put me between you guys at certain points to like get in and out of the convention to like have a little ninja stealth look around. And because of that, I go to these conventions. I'm a magic fan. I love magic. Like I really, really, really love magic. I go obviously to hang out with you guys, and I'm first and foremost. But the thing that I didn't get to see last year was a lot of magic. This year I did. Got to see a
Hell yeah.
lot of magic this year, and from the dealer's hall to the jams at the Ruskin, to the shows and the lectures, I've seen a ton of magic, a ton of really good magic. And I always come away from there. No, I think what made me feel good this year was last year I came away from there deflated. Great in a way that yes, I've achieved a bucket list thing and I was happy with what I did. But I came away from there not inspired. In fact, the opposite. Less inspired because it was like the big thing on my bucket list was that. And it was like the last thing to tick off for magic. And I was like, oh shit, I've fucking done my bucket list. So now I've got nothing left to do. And then I didn't see a lot of magic, so I didn't have anything to like inspire me. This year, I'm inspired. I came away and driving back, I was having tons of ideas. I haven't been able to, I've just created so much stuff since I've seen there, been there, and come back. Even from just like a card trick, not inspired by anything, but I'm just in that magical thinking mode.
Yeah,
You
dude,
know?
it is magical thinking. It's like the fountain of youth when you go to a convention sometimes. It's insane. Because whilst I was there, I came up with like four new effects. I wrote down a bunch of stuff. I filmed a bunch of stuff, planned some stuff. It is just like revitalizing when you see good magic and it takes you off in a completely different direction. Even something as, completely separate. Like I saw some of Hanson Chen's stuff. That got me thinking about something else entirely.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be in the same genre or anything at all. It just, as long as there's a spark of inspiration.
Yeah, I had a great, yeah, that's kind of what it was. Like, I had like a great sit down session with David Peace, Steve Spade. A guy came up, I can't, his name was David. I want to say David. Hopefully it wasn't Daniel. I hope he doesn't judge me if I forget his name. Like Jasper Cherry was there. People coming over and saying hello and going away. Rich Relish was there, obviously, and you, I was sat right next to you, and it was just good to jam like that. And it made me fall in love with magic. Like it made me fall in love with things that I already do. I was showing everyone some rubber band things, and this David guy who has an amazing gaff tech that he's made, like blew us all away. But he was looking over from afar, and I was just doing crazy man's handcuffs, and I was showing Steve Spade the way I do it in the participant's hand. I was showing like
Yeah.
the movements that for it, and as I was doing that, I was showing crazy man's, and this guy David, it's either David or Daniel, please forgive me if I get it wrong, but he was watching from afar, and he hadn't seen it before, and he was like, "What the fuck is that? What's that?" He was only the normal crazy man's, and I think not the vanishing part, and his mind was being blown, and then I showed everyone the slow motion band through ring that happens on the spectator's hand, so it's the physical one, and it was exciting to like bust that stuff out and go over it. And I know it's money for old rope for me, but to see a lot of that material and be reminded of it with like fresh eyes, and I don't know, like that there, I don't know, it's just sometimes you just need a bit of like revitalization. You put it in and you see other people excited about it's all well and good seeing lay people excited about your material, but like sometimes you just it's good to see your peers excited by it, or at least
Yeah.
pretending to be
And it's
to
important that sometimes stuff is tested on magicians because it because the feedback that you get is amazing. And also it, especially with certain elements of mentalism, it helps knowing what works on magicians and what doesn't work on magicians. When we were jamming in the Airbnb, I told you about an old Carb Force I had. I've only ever done that to magicians, and that, I think that's why it works. I don't actually know if that really works on layman. It's so needed to have both of them to test on and like jam
Dude,
with.
do it now online and let everyone think and type in what card they're thinking of. Don't tell them the answer. Just set up the premise.
All right, okay, cool.
I mean,
So
because if you're not going to tell them what card you're trying to force, it's not going to spoil anything, right?
yeah, fair enough. I was going to say because it's a whole thing that is being written up as well anyway.
Oh, because you
No,
said
it's
it was old. No, I thought you'd already put it out there. No, don't worry about
No,
it.
it's fine. I don't care. It's the Black Art podcast. There's only 10 people who listen.
I watch.
No. So when I look at a deck of cards and when other magicians look at a deck of cards, because it's something that you see every day, you kind of start to see personality within these playing cards. I look at my favorite card, the Seven of Diamonds, and I see a sassy diva. I don't know about you, but I look at the seven, the red, the diamonds. I can see someone in high heels. I can see someone with a ring. And it's just the type of personality that either the card projects on towards you or you project onto the card. There's something that you can pick up there. I don't know what it is. But I very often like to ask people, what card do you think is the most likely to commit a crime and end up in prison? And people go for the same two cards, and I don't know why that
Same
is.
two cards, but if you do have a card that you're thinking of now, go to the blackartco.com or the Facebook page, But the same thing, either send us an email via the blackartco.com. You can just click the send us a message button, or you can go to the Facebook page and maybe Jake could post a thread saying just comment down below which card you think is most likely to go to prison. But it'd be interesting to see. Obviously, we're magicians, we do think differently. We do, but it'd be interesting to see because you did it to me and Darren and was 100% correct on both of us.
Yeah, well, I did it to quite a few people, to be honest, because I like retesting older things every now and again. And there's a whole thing I've written up about the personality that each card has, because I think there are some fairly common answers that prop up. So I'll put that out soon.
Okay, good. And I hope I'm going to be interested to see what other people think of that. You could add more to that whole thing as well, which is giving it a reason for why this card would go to prison, or why you could say, for example, and I wouldn't potentially use this, but you could say like, oh, this was my, my great 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 grandfather's favorite card, and he chose this, and this is the card he actually went to prison over. Because he lost a game and he thought this card was going to help him win his lucky hand. You can make whatever script you want. But you could say, so which card do you think would be most likely to go to prison? And then you could have a wallet with a photo of your grandfather holding that particular card.
Oh, that's good. That's
So you
good.
kind of makes it all make sense. And it could be his mugshot. And in his top pocket, it could be like a black and white old 100-year-old mugshot. And he could have it in his top pocket is the card. But then
Well,
it kind of makes the whole trick not relevant, but has reasoning.
whenever I do it, whenever I've spoken about it with people always get weirded out about doing psychological forces because they're worried it will fail. The one thing that I say to people, if you are wanting to practice your psychological forces, don't set it up as a psychological force because you've already failed then. Just have it as a selection. So it doesn't matter whether they get it wrong or not, or whether you mess something up. If you say blah 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 blah, now pick whatever card. If they don't say the card that you want them to choose, then you just pull the card they chose out and say, okay, we're going to use this for this effect then. It doesn't matter, but people get worried about testing it when there's a million outs.
That's such a good point. And yeah, I mean, biggest out ever is invisible deck, but there's some other good outs you can use. And one is just always keeping a double backer in your wallet so that you can cull their card to the top of the deck and then just say in my wallet there's a double back is a playing card, not double backer. The other one is like you're saying. They say it, you don't say you're going to test psychological force. You don't set it up as this one card isolated before you begin. You just say which card will go to prison. If they get it wrong, you say, okay, that's interesting. So I can see how your brain thinks. Now watch this. I'm going to take a card out from the top and just do ambitious card with it. Or sign your name on it.
So the card that people most often choose when I ask which card you think is the most likely to go to prison. Usually I will then say, and if that card was to go to prison for murder, which is the card that you think it would have killed? And what would
Oh,
your
pick off.
answer?
That's an easy force. I know which card you're gonna try and get me to think of.
What would you go for?
Queen of Hearts. 100%.
Yeah, always, always. That's my second favorite of my own card forces.
Absolute no-brainer. Oh, that's good.
It's fun, isn't it?
I love this idea. Dude, that's interesting. The field of going for a card force and then whether it hits or not, but they change their mind to, or you add extras to it. So what would be the thing? For example, if you were trying to force a seven, and then you said, what other card would you have gone for? People like seven and three are best friends, because of that, then they'd be likely to go for like a, if I said, okay, which card would go with the three of clubs, then, oh, sorry, seven of diamonds. Sorry, it would be the three of clubs.
It's such a really weird, interesting field because when people first learn about it, they assume it's very complicated or that they have to follow a script to a T. But you can get away with so much. Like, there is a reason that people go for these things, and that is the difference between a good card force and a bad card force is when someone says, oh, but it usually works. If it's a good card force, it should pretty much always work. There's only a few outliers, and That's kind of how I judge a good card for us. But even if it doesn't work, it doesn't matter. You just take out the card and use it for an effect.
Well, there was a psych force I was doing with you at the room, which we were kind of like just freestyling on. But one that kind of couldn't, couldn't go wrong. But it was just the idea. The whole psych force was just to force a court card, and a court card being the only one the opposite way around in the deck. But the psych force relayed on, relied on. It's just we were just brainstorming, but using the ambiguous term that people use when playing cards anyway, of being face down. So it was something. It was something along the lines of, I want you to imagine spreading this deck towards yourself, and I want you to imagine the faces of those cards staring at you. But I want you to imagine one face in particular. It doesn't matter which one, but imagine looking at it, and I want you to imagine them turning their face down, okay, turning their face away from you. And I'm forget the suit for now, but just think about the which card, which denomination of card would turn its back on you, essentially. And then then you bring out a deck, and then you force the suit however you want. But this idea of just you're basically giving it a character, you're personifying it, and later on there can be a reframe. But you can say, look, so if you were thinking of the seven diamonds, this is seven of diamonds face up, this is the seven of diamonds face down, and then realize the terminology is, oh yeah, of course, yeah, you can say face up or face down, that's a normal thing. But because you've just because you've said like look at stare at the face of the card, blah blah blah, it almost makes them have to think of a court card in the reframe. It didn't really go any further than that, than a brief 30 second or minute long discussion, but with the scope there of if there's only three cards, you can, what I've always done, if like say for example I'm going to force the suit clubs, and I do that, I've always done this and it's never failed, but you just say, I want you to also give this a suit, but don't go for a suit that everybody goes for. Make it a random suit, or even one that you don't even know what it represents. And I always throw out spades, the poker suit. So I say, I want to think about. I want to add a suit to this card, like spades, the poker suit. But give it a random one that you don't think many people will go for, that you don't even really know what it represents. Something completely left field. And then because everyone, you know what diamonds represents, and they know what hearts represent. You've told them what spades represents, and the way you just chat casually, they go to clubs. Anyway, but if you put a card face up, 10 cards down, a card face up in the dead center, and a card face up 10 from the bottom, then if you've got a jack of clubs, queen of clubs, and a king of clubs, then either you hand them the deck and they spread slowly face down, you hand them the deck face up and they spread slowly face up. Obviously, they just don't let them go many past their card. Or if they say the queen in the middle, you just spread to the center of the deck, and then you've got three face up cards in that deck, and you're good to go.
Yeah, man, and I love the I just love the working out of washing away the restrictions in the reframe afterwards. I always think of it's like the mental equivalent of switching in the ungimmicked version of something. And it's
Yeah.
like this sentence I just said is now examinable.
it's so good.
But it's really interesting because in isolation, when you create mostly on your own. Sometimes it's hard to test out those kind of things, especially it doesn't always work over Zoom. It doesn't always work in calls. So when it's a convention, I love going through the back catalog and double checking stuff works.
Yeah, well, it did. I tested the Cloud Psych Force on you. I got Psych Force years ago, and Peter Turner published it in his like 12 Card Forces book or something. And I remember watching him fry a load of magicians downstairs in the Ruskin like 4 or 5 years ago. I did it on you and Darren. Didn't work on Darren, but it worked on you. I don't know if many of our listeners would have read it in Pete's book, but the basic idea is just, I want you to imagine it's like a beautiful day. And you're outside daydreaming, laying on the grass or the beach, and you're staring up at the clouds, just letting your imagination run wild, and you see clouds like in Toy Story. And those clouds start to, maybe you can picture them as one as a value, one as a suit, and just imagine what suit and value they could possibly be. And then, yeah, just from there, I mean, people from here can, they could write their answers in, but let me know. Well, maybe I'll just say it. So the majority of people, high percentage of people, go for eight or nine of clubs. Eight or nine of clubs.
Yeah,
And if
man.
they
Cloud
say
nine, baby.
exact, yeah, Well, that was the original thing. Cloud and Nine used to go together, and that's why they go for a nine. And
Yeah.
that's why it's like, imagine it's a nice day, you're daydreaming, you're feeling good, sort of thing. Anyway, but if it doesn't hit, say that, I think Darren said a King of Diamonds. And great, I'm gonna go through, take out the King of Diamonds. You've let your imagination pick this, but you know there's only one of them now, and then just like ambitious card or anything you want
Yeah.
from.
I do think if people are listening to this and they are someone who gets worried about testing some of these things that they've read out, it doesn't have to mean anything. You don't have to hedge everything on it. Because if Darren didn't go for the force and said King of Diamonds, then he doesn't know what was meant to happen. You're just like, okay, so for some reason that card speaks to you. It's what you saw in your mind. And it doesn't matter where you go from there.
If, however, you put a single card down on the table and say the card that you're thinking of is going to be the card, then you're sort of setting yourself up for potential failure. The only way you can really get that trick right is to like force that playing card ahead of time or during, but like a surefire force. And even then, how many spectators do you know forget their card?
Oh,
They're
yeah.
very, very common. So, but it's, I think it's better to, I mean, it can be more, absolutely more impossible if they go, if they say he put the card down, named a card, and it was that card. It's pretty like real magic. However, we can't do real magic, even though real magic does exist. That's another day. But if you go into it without setting stuff up for failure, but then also reframing is such a powerful tool and influencing their memory, then you can make it feel like you did just exactly that. Like if you start off, for example, with your wallet on the table, right, and you've got, say, three force cards that it could be in your wallet, but they know the whole deck is not in that wallet, right? And now you have them go for the card. And if they get it, now you'd say, look, that wallet's been on the table in full view the entire time. Have I been anywhere near it? No. There's one card in there from the very beginning. I told you from the very beginning to think of one card. There's no other card it could have been. And it's in there. So it feels like the same thing, but you just haven't drawn attention to it beforehand.
Yeah, and there are ways to draw attention to something so that it isn't obvious that you are isolating something. But when it comes round to the reveal, it's like it was meant to be isolated. So when I do the card force that I do, because there are usually only two options that are ever chosen. I don't actually think I've ever had another option given, just those two. Usually one will be in my pocket and one will be in the card case. And I place the card case in the middle of the table. Now, when they look back, that's me placing the card in the middle of the table, but if it doesn't hit and it's the one in the pocket, it doesn't matter. I'm just putting the deck in the middle of the table.
Right. I publish a trick on my Patreon called Chekhov's card. And the tagline was a scientifically perfect card to pocket. But the whole premise was maybe a bit ambitious. But the whole premise is that there's a thing in movies called Chekhov's gun, which is if you introduce a gun in the first part of the movie, that gun has to fire later on in the movie. And I was examining the reasoning behind card to pocket because it's such a powerful trick. But there's it should be there's a lot of factors in it basically, but the essential handling to what happens is that before the trick begins, I just casually take remove a card from the deck and put it in my pocket, but I don't draw attention to it, which in this is Chekhov's gun. So I just go through and take one out, put it in, and say, let's start now. Instead of saying I'm going to make a prediction, this prediction's going to go in my pocket or anything else. It's just something that happens that they recognize, but they don't what's the word? They don't contact, they don't, it's not an event. It's not something like watch this card. It's like, but then when they see it later, they go, oh, and they almost feel like they figured it out. And it's the same sort of thing, like by you placing the box down on the table, but not mentioning it. It's not an element. It's not a hook for the effect. It's just there. But later on, when you call attention to it, they go, oh, yes. Well, I do remember he put that there. So this is part of the effect without then trapping yourself into that corner if it goes wrong.
A part of it is the renaming and reframing as well, because if a dog walks into the room, there is a dog in the room, and then its owner says that dog's name is Jackson, and then Jackson has always been in the room, but before he told you the name, there was just a dog in the room. So when I put the the card box on the table, it is a card box on the table, but afterwards in the reframe and the rename, it's the card has been in jail. And that jail has always been on the table.
Oh, that's great. That's clever.
But oh man, I love it. I love it. It's I need to do more psych stuff.
Yeah. It's in it. The thrill that you get when it hits as well.
Yeah.
There's nothing more thrilling than getting a psych force that hits. And I suppose it's just low, not low hanging fruit, but money for old rope. You're getting free hits because when they hit, there's nothing really more you can, depending on how you frame it, obviously, but it's generally, you can't really get better than that.
No. It's yeah, just a straight hit is great.
And sometimes I find the only difficult thing is making it, not making it, because you can explain it, but sometimes it feels you get more excited than the layperson does. You have to kind of find a way to share that with them.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing necessarily wrong with that, though. I think more people should do magic just because it gets them excited.
Yes. Tony Chang actually said that to me once. I asked him, like, there were people, we were in a bar called Mother's Ruin in New York, and there was loads of magicians in there. And there were some magicians just doing like sponge balls and getting like screams and things. And he was doing like hardcore, technically perfect sleight of hand. And obviously, like when you see a card do a color change, people go, whoa. But if you get two sponge balls in the hand or an omni deck, people just climb the rooftops. That's Magic 101. And I asked him, like, oh, because he performs so much. And I said something along the lines, like, well, why are you doing like the extra difficult stuff here? But if you just want to perform, and it was just like a more of like a theoretical question, not like a intrusive question. I think, but you could be getting reactions like this. And but I wanted to know because I'm like that. I'll do tricks that I'm working on. So, and he said, I do it because I love it,
Yeah.
purely for me. Like that was a I'll always remember that. It was a proper like, oh yeah, you do have to do magic for you sometimes. Hence,
Yeah.
like the whole thing saying it was so like cathartic at Blackpool this year, just doing my old tricks to magicians and seeing their reactions to it because I was enjoying it. I
Yeah.
got done other tricks to fool them, but it was just crazy minds and stuff.
It's just it's such a weird subject because obviously so many people do it for a job and then it becomes
A job.
a job. And that's never what magic has really been for me. I mean, I might get money from certain aspects of it, but it's not, it's still, magic is still this amazing unknown entity, you know, the godhead figure in my life.
Yeah, it's magic first, then business second, always. It has to be.
There is an aspect of performance of magicians which I really like, and that is when it is, if it is a card trick or some kind of physical kind of magic, something that is visible, it's very easy to assert like I am the magician, so you are watching, and that's kind of just implied with what's happening, you know, you get someone's attention, or I'm not explaining myself very well here. I said, you know, if you are in a performance to a magician, you are kind of proving yourself in some ways sometimes. And you do it by being adept at what it is that you do. And then when it comes to mentalism, proving yourself to a magician seems to be so much harder. And when I look back on videos of me performing mentalism to magicians, there's weird unconscious stuff that I notice that I'm doing when it comes to the reveal. And I was looking at some videos the other day, and whenever there's a reveal, whenever I'm about to reveal something, I stand up straighter because I start off hunched up, kind of like meek. Not meek, but like, you know, it's like intimate, closer. And then I stand up straighter and usually will take one or two really slow steps towards them, almost to like get them a bit nervous, but not in like a super intimidating way. It's just like the answer's coming closer towards you. And I never realized until the other day when I was watching some stuff that I do that to magicians. And I think it must be purposefully because, you know, you have to impress the magician. So I don't know what it is. It's bizarre. Just a stray thought entered my head.
The best ones,
Yeah.
the ones you never planned to have.
There was something not entirely to do with Blackpool, but kind of to do with Blackpool that I wanted to bring up on the podcast. So to beat the Blackpool Blues, I stayed another night with Tyler Lunsford, and we went to House of Secrets and saw Matt Cluley and Rylan, the Kid Magician, perform. And then we went on a little road trip the morning after, yesterday. And Tyler came to see Liverpool for an hour or so, and I showed him something really cool in Liverpool that I've never seen used in a magic trick, which should be used in a magic trick, because it is just the best built-in plot and props ever. And it is a pyramid-shaped tomb on Rodney Street in Liverpool, in the graveyard of St. Andrew's Church. And it's this old local, well, it's half legend, half true, because it is true. There was a guy called William Mackenzie, a businessman, quite a wealthy man. I think when I looked it up through the day, his net worth would have been something stupid like 42 million in today's money. But he gambled it all away every single night. He was just a notorious gambler on the streets of Liverpool. And one night he was playing cards with a man called Mr. Madison. And he kept betting and betting and losing all of his money against Mr. Madison. So he made one final bet just as Mr. Madison revealed himself to actually be Satan incarnate, the devil in human form, the man with the hoops for feet. And William Mackenzie lost that hand as well, and he had bet his soul. So the devil said to him, "When you're buried, when you're gone, I'm coming for you. I'm coming to get you, boy." And so his last wishes before he died were to be buried above ground, sitting upright at a poker table with a winning hand, in this pyramid-shaped tomb. Now, there's other stuff to do with that. A lot of that is true, the actual person himself and his habits, but how he was buried might not be entirely true. But that is the local legend and the local lore that's been here since it happened. But that is one of the coolest stories for a card trick ever.
Yeah, and you sent me the video of somebody else going through the details of it, and it's literally that. He was buried with a winning poker hand, even though 16 years after his death, but in a pyramid shaped tomb. Was it on Riley Street, did you say?
Rodney Street, I
Rodney
think.
Street. Yeah, Rodney, sorry, my bad. Playing Mr. Madison the devil, ironically.
Yeah.
Yeah, the trick sort of builds itself, doesn't it? Writes itself. If what was the winning hand, or I mean, there's a lot of talk about Dead Man's Hand, which is something completely different from what I've seen in the In Between Us TV show.
Well,
Get out, I'm cleaning my room.
we were speaking about this the other day, not that in particular, but just the concept of what are the good parts of those types of tricks, and why does it lead to this certain point? And so, if there's only one way the trick can go, is that still a good trick, even though it's linear?
Yeah, I mean, I think so.
Yeah.
But there is something that like definitely could be explored. It's nothing worse than, I mean, even just for the sake of not doing the same trick as everyone else.
Yeah.
You know, that because you get a story like that is so linear, where the trick writes itself, where you just want them to predict the dead man's hand or the missing card from the dead man's hand, which
Yeah.
is a fucking phenomenal trick. And Matthew Wright does have I watched Matthew Wright do an amazing performance of his new version of an effect about that or what's the guy's name? Billy the Kid's dead man's
Yeah, man.
hand, but he has all the
It's good.
photographs, and there's a great bit of script with it where he's you can see one person can see the missing card and they'll never know. So I mean, he did actually extrapolate it further, but I definitely think there's more to be explored from so many different angles, and also just for the sake of being different, like just on a sub and on a little subplot. Whatever, I was doing a build change at my Blackpool lecture last year, and it's probably not as good as the extreme burn change, right? But the problem is, everybody does extreme burn, like
Yeah.
everybody does double cross, and I say a big part of that is the talk, and got like I think it was like a small round of applause, but it was like I can't think of anything worse than going to perform. Right, because for me, magic should feel spontaneous and organic, and it should feel, and this is why I always say magicians are such terrible actors. It should feel like this is only happening in once, so it's special. That's why I think, I don't see stage magic in the same realms of magic. I see stage illusions, which are phenomenal, but I see that as performance art, as in the same realms as dancing, because you know, as you're sitting there as a spectator, you know this is rehearsed, you know this is just going on, whereas magic done close up feels real, and it should feel like the first time you see it. Anyway, my worst nightmare is going to perform and having a lay person saying, "Oh yeah, I've seen so and so down the road do that. Or I watched someone else do that on TV," because suddenly it rips the air out of the room. It tells them instinctively that this is possible.
Yeah.
Even though they're showing them the impossible, they're showing them that this is rehearsed and anyone can do it. You know? So my point being that when I create a lot of magic, sometimes the exploration is just to be different so that nobody's seeing what I'm doing. So when they see me do
100%.
it for the first time, they are seeing that for the first time.
Yeah, that's 99% of the stuff that I ever perform is stuff that I've made myself because I know no one else is doing it.
Yeah, it's got to be that way, I think. And don't get me wrong, there's some things I do, like I do form Omni deck, which could be like the closest thing that anyone else does. And I'm not, you know, I am guilty of the same sins that I chastise for, but I sort of pick my audiences and I know if they've seen live magic or not. I'll tend to find out before venturing down there. Anyway, that being said, the story, what's the guy's name?
William Mackenzie, I think.
Old Bill McKenzie. The doomed gambler.
Yeah, man. I love that story so much. I've heard it since I was a kid, so it's kind of just ingrained into me.
I wonder if you can take elements of it and sprinkle up some lies into it. You know, not lies, but the best like stories have like elements of the truth. And Oscar Wilde was it that said, "Never let the truth get in the way of a good story."
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, I wonder if if you, because they didn't bury him until 16 years after he was dead, right?
He was just buried on a plot of land. His wishes about the pyramid, that was like a gift from his brother 16 years after he died in his memory.
What if you like, what if you say, well, if you actually look into the story,
Yeah.
he never
What the
died.
history books don't tell you is
Well,
that
the
this
history books
pyramid is
don't tell
also
you. Yeah. Is that, no, is that like, is that he didn't, the reason, even though his brother put this pyramid there 16 years later, that's because that's when Bill McKenzie actually died. That whole ruse of the plot of land was never true. Bill went on to play many more card games around many more parts of the country. And in fact, you know, he met a woman many years later who,
Yeah.
but you know, and it maybe it's just, maybe you're just changing the story up a little bit just for the sake of changing the story up. You could
When I was
pretend
looking
you
it
made
up
the
the other
pyramid.
day, apparently there's like four other pyramid tombs in the UK, and all of them have got like good stories behind them, some of them similar.
What
So
if you
there's.
put those four pyramids and trying, what's the word, like when you triangulate them on a
Oh,
map,
yeah.
so you
Yeah, I need
draw a
to do that.
line for real, like do your own research, draw the lines where they intersect or where they would intersect, or say there's one in Liverpool, one in London, one in Scotland, and one in Wales, and they would probably cross over at, I don't know, probably Monmouth or North, I don't know, somewhere around there. And then so you add that in. And now, if they were to go on a map and they start to do this themselves, or maybe you force the name of a place, or you know, you do a roadmap, you get a roadmap out and they force the part of the country in it. You know, maybe you get to do like, maybe it turns into like a semi miniature investigation with them. You're like, you know, I hear
Yeah.
that that actually he settled in a certain part of the country. And you can work that out. I don't know how, you know, you say maybe you could find out and you do it, you sit down together. And when it comes up, this certain place, you think, oh my God, no way, this is actually my heritage is from here. I don't know. You know, it sounds
What if
crazy,
we
but.
actually accidentally find some kind of national treasure hunt? Because that will be my favorite thing in the world. I'm going to have to do some research.
But the thing is, right, that, you end up revealing that they also predicted the dead man's hand or something like this along the lines. But that turns a card trick into a fucking adventure. And they'll never remember that as, oh yeah, he picked my card, I found it. And found it. Sorry, I picked the card, he found it. Or I thought of a card, he nailed it. This now becomes this whole story. Oh my God. And then we talked about that. And we added it on the map. And, da, 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 and it turns out and transpires this. Or maybe you get some background information on them. And because you can go on like ancestry.com and you can find out, like, say you know you're going to be performing at a wedding. And you know that. No, the bridegroom's family history. And you go down, maybe you find out like that an address that a great grandfather of either the bride or groom used to live in, this very specific address. And you tell them that these pyramids, you make up maybe where one is, so that overlays in exactly that point.
Yeah.
And then you know, it sounds absolutely crazy and stupid, but this is going to be amazing, amazing fun to perform and proper, like, exciting story to tell.
Dude, I wish that you could put in that much effort for every trick. I wish it was feasible. But I understand the pain of when someone says, "Oh, like I have to work three weddings a week, and I can't do that with every wedding." But I wish it was possible, man.
But it could be, once you've built up the structure of it and everything that goes around it, maybe you don't go specific as specific as detailing a location of where they're from or things like that, but maybe you've got it so only the names need to be changed.
Yeah, that's true. Oh man, I love this stuff so much. I need to start doing weddings, man.
You should. You
I
literally
know. Yeah. Okay, I'll stop whimsically looking into the air, thinking about wedding gigs. Something so romantic about it, man.
Yeah, there is. See, this is the whole, but don't get me wrong, there is definitely times and places for just doing a straight up card trick.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what I came home and I've just been playing with doing like normal crazy amounts of handcuffs, just playing, doing that, and realizing that like when I look at it and I step back, like that for I always talk about this trick, but it's such a crazy slow motion visual piece of magic where like it sort of accomplishes so much of what it's supposed to. You don't need to do anything else at times, you know? I don't know. What was the word, dichotomy or something? But you know, there is a time and place for creating these incredible adventures and stories that leave them not really focusing on the trick, but more of what happened as a
Yeah.
whole. And
But I
then
think it.
there's time in a dark nightclub doing flash paper lolly reveals.
I think why I talk about economy, like economy of movement and stuff and economics in magic so much is because of that. Because you lead with your strongest foot first, right? And I know that my strongest foot is always going to be the scripting and speaking to someone. So
True.
the actual effect itself can be the silliest thing in the world, but I know that I'm layering it and flavoring it with other stuff. So I can make the most out of the tiniest things. I was talking to you the other day about a marked deck. The simplest thing you can do with a marked deck is someone selects a card and you tell them what card they've chosen. I've done that trick 1,000 times, but each time there is a different layer to it, there's flavor to it, and I'm leading with my strongest foot, and it doesn't feel like a card trick. It feels like I've went out the room and a ghost has came to the room and looked at what card they've chosen or whatever scripting I go for. But it is like economy and making something simple actually feel really, really strong.
Yeah, that's such a good point to make. Oh yeah, this is the thing. We were talking about all about ghosts coming into the room at Blackpool. We were on about just beautiful like opening lines.
Oh yeah.
We were on about this whole premise of saying like just the line of if these walls could talk, sometimes they tell the truth, you know? And just opening with that and then doing, even if it's like a cut the deck and think of a card, but obviously much better. You know, we were thinking like more along the lines of hiding an object or having the participant hide an object. And then you come in and you pretend the walls tell you where it is. You go and taking it further. But just
Dude.
sometimes a catching, like, you know, like which book is it? The Dark Tower, best opening line ever. The man in black fled across the desert and the gunslinger followed. But, or something, is that the full line verbatim?
I think so.
The man
It's been
in
a while since I've read the Dark Tower books. But no, I agree with you. And I think once people realize that there's a certain point where you're just trying to get the most impressive things you can. And then I feel like the next stage is trying to make this most simple thing possible more impressive is so much more fun to me.
It's also a bit more freeing when you perform too, because once you know like the work is done, the forcing, the whatever it needs to be, you know, whatever it needs to be. Once you know you're not, because there's nothing worse than sort of going forth about to do this big reveal of something, and you're like, I don't even fucking know if they're thinking of the right card or if I've got the force number correct on the calculation, or there's something very freeing where you can just, like, right, shoulders down, head up high, fucking blast this reveal out, because I know I've done a cross-cut force earlier and they've nailed it.
Yeah, just
Also,
the go on.
I
I
was
was just
thinking
gonna
about.
say the data work's just so minuscule that it doesn't even like you can focus on everything else that makes a performance good.
I was thinking of a very simple way to enhance a card force yesterday.
Oh.
So, say you wanted to force a card that's going to be signed. Well, I don't know in which world this would make the card force to be signed better or more practical, because for whatever reason. But the idea would be you do a crosscut force, but say you want to force the two hearts, and you're going to have it signed on the face, which. Just ignore this bit for why it's unreasonable for now or silly. But if you put like a king on top of that too, so you let them do the crosscut force, and you say, so cut the deck anyway, mark it, blah 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 blah. All right, lift up where you cut to and take a look at that card. And what I want you to do is sign it nice and big on the face. Hopefully it's a card that's got a fair amount of white space on it. And then you'll see them be like, if that one hasn't got a lot of white space, could you just go to the next one? Stupid little thing, but just adds that like a little bit level, a little bit of like plausible deniability to it, a little bit of extra a level for a layperson, not for magicians, obviously, but just that level of, oh well, actually, I did pick one card, but it wasn't ideal, so I changed it to a different one. But in their head, it's like it shows they had a fairer choice.
Yeah.
Stupid, stupid thing, and I don't know where, because. Normally, you'd want to sign a court card because you can duplicate that edge signature, or you can duplicate a signature in the centerpiece a lot easier on that camouflage area, as opposed to a white space of a normal card. But just something to be put on like a in a pigeonhole box, because one day that might be useful.
Yeah, dude, we spoke about it loads before. That's something that goes in the drawer, and then in 4 months' time, you'll go, "Oh, this plot I have, I could use that in it."
Yeah, it could just be that you want them to use a number card. So you like cut the deck, think of the card there. If it hopefully it's a number card. If it's not, could you just go to the nearest number card that you've got there, Just a little 1 degree, as John Gustafara says, or Gustafara Pharaoh, say 1 degree change, but when they're thinking later on, could have been that. Who knows?
Yeah. And anything that looks like it's thrown you a curveball is good because it couldn't be predicted.
Yeah, exactly.
The, not necessarily in a blip, something going wrong, but just, well, how could you know that, I wasn't able to write on this card?
Yeah, true. I was thinking of a fun trick yesterday, and I've got like a bunch of different methods for the second part of it. But I've no, I've spoken about this before, but Kaylee came up with a method, and I don't know if this has been done before. But we went to Germany, Frankfurt, to see the Erdnase premiere,
Oh,
Searching for
yeah.
Erdnase, or whatever it was called, and on the bus going to the airport back. She figured out the way of the cut deeper force. So you say you have your force card on top of the deck. You say cut a small pile, turn them face up, and now cut a bigger pile, turn them face up, and now spread through whatever the first face down card is. Take a look at it, remember it. Brilliant hands off force. I know a lot of people use this in shows or theaters and stuff, whatever. But it's very very beautiful, fooling hands off force. So Kaylee said, if you did this with a mnemonica, you can actually figure out how many cards they have face up too. At the end. And so basically the way it works is that if any stack, but let's say they cut the first few piles, the first cards, and you turn them face up, and you see there's a, say it's in normal order, and you see a 10 on the face, and then they cut those and turn them face down, and this time you see what would be the king, right? So they just cut an extra three cards. Well, 10 to 3 is king. If it was in Monica, let's say there was a two of spades, which is the 10th card, and then they when you look again, there's a king of clubs, which is the 18th card. You now know there's eight cards in that face up stack. So the idea would be that you've already got to pre-force the force. You can reveal that, say, in the marker, the four of clubs somewhere else, but But then, because you now secretly know the that they have eight cards, which really is the impossible part of it, the bit you couldn't potentially know for real. Well, you know you could, but then if you couldn't find a way of either, I wouldn't say thumb right in, so I just don't like that practical that method. But you could have a four of clubs, say, in another deck. You spread the deck as one face up card. That was the four of clubs, but written on the back is the number eight, which is, and you'd also cut eight cards face up. You know, or 10 or 12 or 21. And I have a couple of different methods. One of them is really fun, but I won't share it on here. But I thought maybe because it's coming towards the end of the episode, we could set it as a bit of homework. And how many different fun methods can you come up with to reveal a number written on the back of a force card from for that effect? So the number has to be interchangeable between, you know, 0 to 20, probably, because when they do that cut deeper force, that's generally about how I say there's always about, I don't know, I'd wager about 10 face up at the end. So, but I have a couple of fun methods for it. I'd love to know if anyone else just takes it and runs with it as well.
Yeah, I would actually really like to hear about that because I went off into my own little dream world then thinking about presentations for
Yeah, I can see your the cogs turning.
it. Apologies.
You know, it's good.
It's so cool though. I can't wait for Kaylee's first release.
Well, I don't know. I might share the method. I probably will share the method on the Society of Secrets on my Patreon because I don't know if it do. People love the visual gimmicks on YouTube, but I think it's got a cool method hidden. The cool method for the number change, anyway, at least to the society.
I think so. The premise of knowing how many cards someone has in their hand as well. There's so many story options for that. There's so many ways to present it.
Yeah, there is. And yeah, even if they took the yeah, because they cut once, cut again, and you could then just get a quick peek of it and say, actually, take those cards on the table. I don't want to see them, but take however many cards are face up now. I literally have no idea. Maybe sit on them and remember the first, or just remember that number. Remember the first face down card and put everything back together. Give them a nice big shuffle. So now you know a card and a number. For example, say there was 12 cards face up that you calculated and you know the four of clubs. Well, now you can set yourself up for an eight hand. So you're like, look, you're thinking of a number, you're thinking of a card. Both of those were generated in your hands. You cut a very specific amount of cards, which neither of us knew beforehand. You also cut to a random card, and if it was one card more, one card less, you had a different bigger pile, everything would have changed. However, as you're doing this, you could be taking that four of clubs from another deck, which is already in another deck. I would say, like, you could do something cool, which is to start with that four of clubs. I'm always saying four of clubs because it's in the first mnemonica, and place it at 10th in the other deck. Because then, if they have seven cards face up, you can just ditch three. Or if they have 15, you can just add five, but just leave it floated in that 10th position. But then, if they do happen to have 10, you just now have a like a very, I wouldn't say perfect eight count because nothing was freely named for either the number or the card, but the conditions certainly seem fair.
Yeah, that's super fun as well. And you've got all the cover you need because as you catch the glimpse, you can turn around and say, you know, now count them off into your hand. I don't want to see. Or, you know.
Exactly,
You
yeah.
can turn around and do whatever you need to do to the deck that you have.
What you could do is this. You could have them do it under the table, so it's sight unseen, okay? And then you say, I mean, you spread through those face-up cards and count how many there are. And once you get to the first face-down card, remember what that card is and square everything up. Okay, so you do this. You say, now bring everything up. And they bring it up and you get that quick peek. And you, oh, sorry, can you also turn those cards down? I don't want to know how many cards you had face-up. So it's like a little, oh, accidental moment, but you've got all the info you need to do that. Or you can do that in reverse. So whilst they're counting, you can then be calibrated. So you could just have them do it under the table, cut once, cut deeper, turning it all over, and say, and then bring the cards out. Oh, actually, stop taking back under and count how many face-up cards you have. You know, so you just get a quick peek. To them, it's nothing. And then you could just calibrate the other deck.
Calibrating the deck. Very cool.
Calibrate in the deck. And of course, like people forget that when you have a deck, if your card like is in 10th position, then you could either do double dealing. If it was like say there were seven cards,
Yeah.
if you were gonna deal to reveal that four, because it's gonna be maybe face up, it's a lot more startling, but you can say you need to deal seven, you deal one card one card regularly, two cards regularly. That next card, just push over two, even if it's like not even perfectly square, deal that two down, and again do that another two times or three. Is it? It would be twice or once more, I think. But then you're dealing 10 cards at seven, or if there's say there's 12, then just do a few fake deals where you go one, two, three, the fourth card, you just slap your thumb onto the dealt pile and don't actually deal a card. And you do that for the I do that like the next rhythmic point for me, which is like the eighth card. You know, it's just like one, two, three, four would be nothing going down, but it looks like you are, and they don't pay attention because you slow down for the last three. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight. And they've already just fakely dealt three cards. Might get to 12, 9, 10, 11, 12. And then so you don't have to displace any cards at all. Or you could do the tamarisk thing where if it's at the 10th card, you can push over a block of four and drop them down. Then you push over and openly display, you push over a block of five, drop them down. Now they're the fourth card, the four of clubs, if it's face down here. So this time it'd have to be face down. But then if it was anything over 10, say it was 13, you push over a block of three, you drop them on top, wait for a few moments for time misdirection, and that's clearly 13 cards. You turn over the top card and it is the four. You know, it's like that tamarisk number thing. Very, very deceptive. But again, no displacement as long as there's more than 10 cards. And that also works if it's just in eighth position as well.
Yeah,
Or ninth, tenth, whatever.
I just thought of something that is it's probably been done a million times before, but because we're talking about cut deeper, it made me think of it. If you had a double backer on the top of the deck, and you asked them to think of any number they want, like between 1 and 20,
Yeah.
and deal out that many numbers, and then turn them face up and put them back on top of the deck, they've dealt 10 cards, say, but now when they take off the face up cards, they've got nine,
Oh.
and they've done it themselves away from you.
So one vanishes.
So one vanishes, yeah.
Because the other thing you could do, which I've experimented with before, is if you do it, if you put a double facer on the face of the deck. So let's say on the bottom of the deck, it's a queen of hearts, but on the back of it, there's a three of spades. So now what you can do is if you as long as they don't look at the deck while they're doing it, you can say, take the deck, cut it in half, and turn the cards over. Okay, and square everything up. Now when they spread through, the first face up card they'll see will be the three of spades, and they won't be able to tell it's a double backer because it's just lost in. But they can't look at where they're cutting to with their eyes because they'll see it's not a three of spades or whatever. Then you know what I mean. But that's a way of doing it a very clean way, so it's not the cut deeper, but cut deeper works perfectly, you know. I suppose then, no, Jake, if that face up card was, oh no. No, I was going to say, if it was like 10 from the bottom, then you could force the amount of cards, but that wouldn't work because they're always going to cut a different amount from below that. Never mind. Ignore me. Ignore me. Completely ignore me. Anyway, we've been running long enough. I can't stay chatting for ages today. This is what I mean, man. I'm in such a zone right now after Blackpool.
Good.
Worth every penny just for the feelings of it.
Yeah. Before we go, then, is there anyone? I mean, we can't run through everyone, but is there anything that deserves a bit of a shout out for, like, being, one of the highlights of the convention or anything?
Apart from hanging out with you, Sam, and Tyler, which was the best, it was just like perfect. Then, what about you? What do you have in mind?
Some of TCC's stuff was great.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, some gorgeous, like, affordable mentalism products for people.
Yeah. S Crazy Sam, you know, Crazy Sam Huang, I think his name is. Seeing all his stuff in the flesh is just otherworldly. Like he's dominant. He's absolutely a superstar. I loved Ben Hart's show, Jadoo. Very different magic show. Very, very atmospheric. Did it on a circular stage and performed all around. That was just like inspiring. From like this, the tricks were great, obviously, but like the story elements that he was using were just good. Were fantastic and yeah, just like that was super fun. But yeah, I can't think of any there was not like one real standout, but I think that is standout for me, that there was just so many good factors to it all in general.
You know what was rad? Getting to meet a bunch of people who listen to this podcast.
Oh yeah, Rob Fisher. I only briefly got to speak to him, but I wish I'd spent more time with him. He was great.
Yeah, I had a load of people come up just randomly in dealer's hall or whilst we were walking around and say that they love the podcast.
I
It's
didn't get
pretty
a
cool.
chance to speak to John Morton, which I'm sad about because he's a living genius. But I'm also glad because people who are like who are gods in my eyes, like I think scare the shit out of me. I'll just stop.
I got very scared when John came and sat down next to me and said he listened to the
Yeah, it makes us think like, oh God, people listen to this shit and judge
podcast.
us silently.
But thank you, everyone who did come up. It was awesome meeting people from all over the world.
Yeah, same. That's like, yeah, I suppose that's the real highlight. It shows that like what we're doing is not falling on deaf ears, hopefully.
It's nice to have the reminders sometimes, because sometimes you look back and go, "We just absolutely chatted shit for an hour."
Which is true also.
Sometimes it's true.
Yeah. Anyway, until next week, folks, thanks for listening in. Drop us a message. Don't forget to let us know about that psych force. Go to theblackartcode.com and then hit us up either via a message or through the Facebook group and let us know what card you thought of. Which card is most likely to go to prison?
Yeah. Peace.
Say, until next week, folks, see you next time. Peace. Also, peace.
Peace,
Peace.
peace.
Peace out.